podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 40 of If This Is a Podcast and What's Christmas. Apologies for the gap last few weeks. I think I was whining about this when I did the last episode. Trying to coordinate other people's schedules when you're 8 time zones away can get a little bit tricky. It's not so much an excuse because I'm going to hold my hands up here and go, it's my stupid bloody fault and being a bit shit here and there, but a combination of work being a little bit more pressing than usual and things like that meant that it's just been a little bit harder to put the episodes together. So hopefully that little blip will end because I'll certainly have the next few weeks queued up for you. So today I'm talking to the lovely, wonderful, self-proclaimed nicest man in advertising, Danny Brooke Taylor. If you think I'm being rude about him by saying self-proclaimed nicest man in advertising, please listen to the entire podcast because right at the end, there's an explanation of that. He certainly was very nice. And we go through some other interesting things that we haven't covered. I haven't covered with other people. I think starting off in a non-London agency and making a huge success of your career is one of those things. It's kind of unusual, but Danny did it. The merger of MCBD and Dare in the sort of around 2010-ish kind of area, that was interesting as well. I think if we'll think back 7 or 8 years or even 10 years to how the digital so-called revolution was happening and what that was going to mean for traditional agencies, that merger was one of the things that was at the kind of, I don't know, at the forefront of, you know, what would the combination of these two things really result in. So, yeah, that's what we chat about. And, you know, it's part of my startup series, mini part startup series to have him discuss a lot of what happened with the beginning of Lucky Generals. So that's what we chatted about. You don't want to hear me talk anymore. Here's my chat with Danny. Cheers.
Thanks very much for taking the time to join me, Danny. Very kind of you.
No worries, Ben. It's a pleasure.
Okay. Well, at the risk of just repeating myself for the 30, whatever it is, if time, I do like to start at the beginning because I do think that people have different stories about how and why they got into advertising, and I'd be very interested to hear yours.
Yeah, I think probably like loads of people my generation, there was I think it was only about 3 TV channels, so you'd end up sort of binging on telly on a rainy afternoon after school or Saturday mornings, and I remember when the banana splits had finished or whatever was on telly, I remember the ads coming on and they were as exciting. And I just sort of enjoyed the colour and the energy and the fun that these brands were sort of pumping out into my little head at the time. You know, and I remember being excited by even posters driving around in the back of my parents' car. There'll be posters for probably booze and fags, actually, but they were, because they weren't allowed to say anything. They tended to be sort of riddles and things, and to working out. Decoding those was a nice little puzzles for a kid to do. I mean, that's probably why I ended up drinking booze and smoking fags. But I sort of enjoyed this. It was a form of entertainment, and I couldn't believe that there was actually a job in it. That was years later. But I think I found it exciting as a world. Not that I really understood it or knew anything about it at the time.
And what was your first step to actively try and get into that world? Did you go to Watford or anything like that?
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what I'd done. I'd tried graphic design, which I was really interested in graphics, but through the sort of ephemera of music and album covers and magazines and all of that kind of stuff. And I love the relationship between images and type and communication and then even trying to sort of put that kind of thing together myself on a graphic design course, I realized I was a bit shit at it because I couldn't really do the detail, but I enjoyed the thinky bit. I enjoyed the big marker pens, squeaky pens bit before, where you thought you tried to sort of solve a problem, and then you realized that's what you're going to do, and you could imagine what it looked like. But then, of course, it didn't, because I didn't have the skills to design it. So then again, finding out that there was actually a course that was for people who weren't very good at the executional bit but enjoyed the thinky bit, that's when I went down to Watford, and I was Tony Collins' first year, actually.
Which year was that?
It was 1990, I think. Mm-hmm. And I blagged on because I hadn't done a degree or anything. And it's a post-grad course, and I was, I think I was 19. And so I was just in Corfu, dicking around and banging out flyers for shitty nightclubs and things. And then I'd gone on the Tony Cullingham's interview process before, having done that copy test thing, which I still advise people to do. I think it's brilliant. And then I got this call in just before September from my mum and dad saying, you better come back because you've got in at Watford course. So I was pretty jammy to get on it, really, because it was full of very bright, considerably more grown up and mature and sensible people than me, who'd all chosen the industry having, you know, some of them had been in account management. They'd got in the career, in the industry, in the agency, but felt that they were in the wrong bit and had the courage and to start again, go back to college. Whereas I just sort of, I liked funny things and bright, fizzy things, and was staggered that there was a job and someone who's going to help me be able to make a living out of it. So, I got in at Watford, and I've maintained a relationship with that place as well. Tony still wears the same bleached jeans that he did on the day he interviewed me, and he still has the same cheeky smile. So it's nice to be able to sort of involve that kind of people that were part of your sort of early stages in your career. It's nice to involve them in the agency. So I see a bit of him.
Yeah, I've been asking if I can do a chat with him, actually, because I think he, as much as anyone else, is sort of at the kind of fountainhead of much of British creative advertising. And he's kind of been somewhat positive about it, but we haven't quite made it happen. But I'd really like to have a chat with him. So did you find a long-term partner there, or was that afterwards?
So I finished I'm from just south of Manchester, in the North Derbyshire, a place called Buxton. So I was down in Watford and skinned. And Watford's a shithole, you know. And I thought I was in London and I wasn't. So then I did move to London, and it was a real Dick Whittington experience. You know, I ended up going back to Manchester because I had no money, and I was suffering from acute anxiety as well. I was getting really sort of hardcore panic attacks, and I just needed to go home and sort stuff out and start again, really, which is what I did with the love of friends and family and stuff. And I started again in Manchester, actually. I started JWT, but then most of my time was at a place called BDH, where I just sort of, I got excited. I realized that it was the right industry, and I hadn't, London hadn't worked that time around, but I was in an agency which cared about the work, and I learned tons there. Some really good people who'd chosen to not be in London, but that they were very good. So it was very beneficial time for my sort of learning and understanding what the hell the job was about. I think I always harbored a desire to get back to London, though. And I think that was probably accelerated by the fact that fortuitously the agency, BDH, was bought by TBWA. So I felt really connected to this big, exciting, creative network, even though I was in Manchester and it was raining and I was listening to New Order or whatever. I felt connected to something bigger. And that was when TBWA was being creatively driven by Trev as well. So, you know, the best work around. as the acronym TWA, it made sense at that moment, and it was nice to feel part of that family. And then ultimately, having chatted to Trev and stuff, I was able to sort of make that move down to London to do it, to catch up on where I had always hoped to have been.
And just because I haven't asked anyone else who's had that experience, what's the kind of difference between the London agencies and some of the ones outside? Because you hear about them, and they definitely won a few awards while I was, you know, down there. But is it a very different vibe working in a Manchester agency to a London one?
I think I was pretty fortunate, really, because I was very driven to do the work that I was inspired by anyway, regardless of the geography. I was still inspired by what was coming out of Mother and Hal Henry and TWA or Crispin's or whatever. You know, I could see this work, and I wanted our work to be not distinguishable by our postcode. You know, I wanted us. So I had this, because I wasn't in it, I was sort of driven and perhaps more motivated even more so to be doing work that was of a standard. And the other lucky thing was that meanwhile, Dougal Wilson and co were at the Leith in Scotland, so they were pumping out amazing stuff for Iron Brew and things. So we would have this love-hate relationship with those guys who are there was an advertising awards called the Roses, which was the regional awards. And I basically spent about 5 years of my life getting a silver to one of Dougal's golds. I only ever saw the back of his head for about 5 years. I used to just throw bread rolls at him and things. But I think there's very good people who aren't necessarily in London and have chosen to be not in London. However, I don't think that there is the ambition I don't think you get the best briefs and the best ambitious clients who've chosen to go to a regional agency. You've got to do a hell of a lot of work to get that, you know, to get the desire in the client's mind as much as the agency's mind. You want people to come to you to make good work. I think that's harder, because that's a given in London.
Yeah.
There's very good people, and I enjoyed it a lot. So and I learned shitloads. So it was all good.
And so, what was the process of you moving down? Had you risen to CD up there, and then been sort of plucked for the next stage?
It's a good point, because I was thinking about this, knowing I was talking to you. I think our creative director was a guy called Al Dickman, and he was he'd sort of elevated beyond being a creative director into a sort of chairmanly role. And he was, I had a really good relationship with him, and he wanted me to step up to be CD, which felt a bit early. I think I was 27, and it was literally, it was when CD was, creative director was the sort of board member level of the agency, not just a creative director of account. So it was a biggie. At the time, I thought, you can't sort of say, no, hold on a minute, can you give me a call in a year's time when it's more suitable for me? You just have to sort of, you have to say yes to those things. And I did, and I'm glad I did, because it helped me realise what it means to be a creative director. I mean, literally, you are directing creative people and the creative process and everyone involved in that, rather than just, you are a very senior, very good creative, so now you need a pay hike and a new title. I learned what the day job was about, because I had to, really.
So was there like a call from TBWA London, or were you asking to go down there? How did that move happen?
It was both things, really, and I ended up out one night with Trev, and I said, I've got to come to London. And he said, well, you better come here then, mate. And so it happened very quickly. And we just had, my wife Janie and I just had our first kid, and she was 6 weeks old. And we moved down, and it was all a bit random and a bit crazy. But it was weirdly, it felt like the right time. I was sort of ready. And like I said earlier, I felt as though I got back on track, really. I felt as though I'd step sideways from the trajectory that I'd hoped for, and but then ended up back on the, having had some nice times, I felt like I got back on track and was in an agency. It was very exciting. I remember arriving at TBWA thinking, Jesus, this was like Galacticos. This was Trev at one end of the building and one end of the department and Paul Silvan at the other, and to Neil and Clive and Tony Mateer and people who shelves full of awards, and you know, it was exciting and daunting in equal measure.
And which year are we talking about?
This is 2004. So thrown straight into a general election campaign with Trev, which was really exciting, basically demonising the Tories, having fun writing silly things and making Tories look stupid, with the big squeaky Ben that I'd always hoped to have in a swivelly chair in an office in London. So all was good. And then I think McTia walked in actually and grabbed my coat off the peg. McTia had just won the Grand Prix at Cannes for Mountain, having the year before won Black Pencil for Levi Twisted. So he walked into my room, and I knew that I'd heard that he was a spiky character. And he grabbed my coat off the hook behind the door and threw it at me and said, "You and me need to go for a pint." And so this is like 11 o'clock in the morning on day three or something with a wife and a baby at home. And I ended up getting pissed with Mutia and feeling very at home and settled and happy. Because I realized that there was just a load of people who were trying to make good work and have fun doing it. And it wasn't any different than anything I'd wanted to do anyway. I felt much more at ease quite quickly.
Yeah, it's interesting because I spoke to Chris and John about that time as well, and they obviously...
Yeah, of course Chris and John were there. They were, they'd just stepped out. I think they'd just been the window at Selfridges around that time.
Yeah, and there is something, because I remember when I first turned up at Abbotmead Vicars in 1998 and walking around the department going, oh, Tom and Walt are there. Oh, Steve and Vic are there. Oh, Paul and Malcolm and Nick Worthington and whatever. And there is a really intoxicating feeling, I think, of being around the best people in the business. And I think it really, makes you raise your game and feel like you've got to, you know, at least justify being there as well, I guess.
Massively so, Ben. It's so, you're so conscious of it, aren't you? Every morning you think, shit, I have to create some work, which I feel at least I can press play on or hold up and be proud of with this lot. And I think, like when you're like me, shit at tennis, and you play tennis against someone who's really good, you play the best you've ever done. I think you respond and sort of dig a bit deeper, I think.
Sure. And if my chronological memory serves me right, you were creative director not long after 2004, weren't you, at TBWS? Sure.
Absolutely right. So I got there 2004, felt settled, went to a Christmas party, started to make some work and thinking, this is good, I like it here, and this feels right. And then Trev called me upstairs where he was having a meeting with Paul Bainsfair, and they told me that Trev was going to do B&B, and would I and Tony like to take over the creative directorship. So again, I thought, shit, this isn't, the timing's terrible. I'm not ready for this. And but that's the little voice in the back of your head. And then you sort of, your mouth ends up taking over saying, that would be amazing and that's great and let's do it. Because, you know, you have to grab those opportunities because they aren't necessarily going to wait for you. And it felt a little bit early, but again, it was... one of those things that you have to, there's come with the hour kind of things, you just got to do it. And I think I was, you know, it was easier because I was with Tony, and so Tony had got the medals. I was relatively green in the sense that I'd just arrived from the lower leagues, as people would perceive it. But I'd got experience in running a department. I'd done it for 6 years, so I think as a team we probably We're never going to fill Trev's shoes, but I think we were probably the best option at their disposal at the time, maybe.
Yeah, and can you give us a little bit of what it was like in the post-Trevor TBWA era? Because he was such a, I guess, imposing figure of that agency. He was TBWA for all the time I'd known it up till then, so a good 10-plus years. What was it like having the sort of, I don't know, Ravens leaving the Tower of London and having to then look after it?
Yeah, I gave Trevor a little note, which was the TBWA headed piece of paper, and I'd cut the letters T and B out of it, and I'd just see you, mate, thank you. It did feel like that. I think it's one of those sort of David Moyes kind of jobs where if you don't do it, you've chickened out, and if you do it, then it's always you're always going to be the guy who's followed the guy. But the main problem was that the big pieces of business were leaving as well. So the three Telkom Account and Abbey, which was Building Society, which became Santander, was out, and a few other things. So from a business perspective, once things get knocked, there's a negative momentum, which is very, very hard to turn around. So it was difficult emotionally, but from an agency culture perspective, but because the Trev and Bill had left, but it's also very difficult from a business perspective. It's really hard. You learn from that kind of thing, I guess.
Yeah, and was there, I mean, being part of a big group agency like that, was there a lot of kind of, I don't know, pressure or advice coming from higher up within the TBWA kind of network about what to do and how to do it?
No. What had happened was, I think, one of the great successes of TBWA London at the time, and what I think TBWA as a network encourage and nurture anyway, is that they are a network of independents. So I think Trevor enjoyed, I hope you'd agree with me in reading it this way, that I think he'd enjoyed being an independent agency that happened to be part of a network. You know what I mean? I think it felt like its own gang. So I didn't really feel as though I'd got advice from anyone on Madison Avenue. Because we felt like an independent office anyway.
Yeah. And so there was 3 years of that before Miles Cowcroft. How did that transition come about?
2005, yeah. So 2005, 2006, 2007. Yeah, so I was ready for a move, and I wanted to... I sort of looked around at what was out there, and there was this agency called MCBD, which you mentioned, Paul and Malk, earlier. They had set up with Jeremy and Helen, the M and the C, and I saw it as a really, really smart independent company that was perhaps it was known as a grown-up startup, and it was known as, they'd done some really good work. They'd done I think the Alan Wicker campaign had just come out, the Hello World campaign, which I really liked, and they'd I think that they were seen as a little bit sensible and perhaps a little bit dry, and they needed to sort of work out how they were going to sort of They needed to kick on again. And so that was the brief, and I loved that brief, because that was essentially let's come and raid the drinks cabinet. Let's get naughtier as an agency, which was a nice thing to be part of. And working with Paul and Mal was brilliant. They were, I guess, as you'll probably know yourself, Ben, they're true gents and phenomenally talented practitioners of what we do. So that it was nice. I felt as though I was joining some people who had some compassion and were willing me to learn and succeed from there. You know, it's their business as well. Their names are above the door. So, you know, that's quite a biggie for them to bring someone else in as the creative director of the agency. So I did my best to be conscious of that and sort of respect that. But we started to get some traction with, we won some Virgin business and we did some fun stuff there. And we did Hovis, which started to give us some confidence and it was really good time, actually, really good time.
Yeah, and how did that dynamic kind of work? Because, I mean, I always think it's interesting when, you know, you have CD founders of an agency, and were they very hands-off, or was there a kind of, they'll do some bits, you'll do others?
They were, do you know what, it's a really good question. I'm thinking about it now, they were really gracious, because I think they wanted me to succeed, because it was in their interest. I think they wanted to take a step up and perhaps concentrate on a couple of things themselves, but they wanted me to sort of hire some new teams or form a relationship with some of the others that were already there, and wanted me to do a bit of the new business thing. So my relationship ended up being more with Helen Cowcraft, actually. So she was she was the new biz, perhaps AMV when you were there. I don't know, but yeah. She was certainly Tom and Walt's suit of choice, because she's phenomenally brilliant at creating an environment where the best work can happen, and helping create the space and the relationship with the client to enable that. So I really sort of gravitated towards her. I saw that was where the chances of me doing some work that I was proud of was going to lie. And then also, strategically, Andy Nairn was there, and he was. Do you know Andy as well, Ben? Was he? Because he was at Abbott Media's.
I do. I've met him a few times because we have a mutual friend or two, and yeah, I've certainly come across him. Lovely guy.
Yeah, he's a lovely pisshead guy. He's a lovely guy. I love working with him because he's a straight talking strat in the sense that he will go off with this huge, great big volume of data and information, devour it. He was a trained lawyer, so he just studies the detail and then comes back to me and says, you know what this is all about? This is about, and he would have turned dry, factual stuff that would bore me to tears. He'd turn that into something compelling, an insight that, you know when you get those great briefs and you just stare at your head tilts back and you just look at the ceiling straight away because you want to think of stuff. He's so good at that. And then, of course, you're armed with substance and you're armed with the data to be able to sell it and give it some rigor and things, because that's where it started anyway. So, yeah, it's me, Andy and Helen. Paul and Malk sort of rather generously allowed that to happen. And I guess that's where that relationship formed. And we became friends as well, which I think was important. Good thing about friends that you work with is you can fall out with each other because something was a bit crap today, knowing that it won't have a fundamental effect on your relationship, or you can celebrate with each other because it matters even more because your friends in the high points are even better. So I think finding friends in the agent, in the industry is a thing that I've been now enjoying, having found that those two guys.
Cool. Well, we'll get into the whole Lucky Generals thing in a sec, because in between that, obviously, we've got the merger with Dare. And I find it really interesting to think back to that kind of era when there's this sort of digital, it almost felt like they were like digital tanks on the lawn, even though they were the kind of new guys in town. And then there was the traditional agencies and whatever. So Miles Calcraft and coming together with Dare, I think, was a really good epitome of how that relationship kind of happened. So could you give us a bit of an insight into why, how it happened and what happened after, you know, when, you know, how did you operate once the merger had gone through?
You're so right. That moment in time was really strange, wasn't it? I think everyone was, there was varying degrees of paranoia, fear around who was, were the traditional agencies dinosaurs? Was it all about digital? And then the debate was, I sort of felt myself looking beyond it being a, I genuinely was excited by the fact that technology could and was in other aspects of my life. I, you know, do you remember all the stuff that Chris Milk was making for the Arcade Fire and the Johnny Cash and things? Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing that, thinking that is kind of what we do, except it's bigger and it's turbocharged by the fact that it's social and it's, is this what digital is? Because I like this. This isn't the boring pop-up ads that are irritating me. This feels like it's what Punch Drunk were doing to theatre. It feels as though it was making me closer to the product or the content. It was, and then as a creative, if our job is to make an idea fly, I felt really excited by the potential. I was excited by it. I'd realized I'd got tons to learn because I can't even remember when we all first went on Twitter, or I bailed out of Facebook because I was pissed off with having to sort of keep that, that's a job, isn't it? Running your own Facebook.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And I bailed out of that. But then I'll tell you what had happened. The Dare had a cool name. Dare had made some really good work, which I thought was genuinely creatively exciting, as opposed to just ones and zeros digital. And then I met Flo, and Flo Heist was such a good lad. And we got on really, really well very quickly. And the upside of that was that it suggested that the two agencies would fit together very well, because one was a traditional advertising agency and one was the digital agency of the decade. So what could possibly go wrong? And the two creative directors get on very well, and have got a hunger and ambition to do fresh new work, born of insight and ideas, but powered by what technology and social and stuff could bring. You know, this was like Bionic Man kind of stuff. You know, finally we could sort of put tech and muscle together and all of this kind of stuff that we were excited by. Suddenly got very difficult when we realized that a lot of digital stuff was there's a hell of a lot of business in a back end build for a website, which meant that you needed a lot of people to do that. And so culturally, that was, it all boiled down to culture. The wheels ended up falling off because although we were sat on a table together and connected, the two businesses were very different. Which is a real shame. But I got out.
Yeah, just to go back into the Dare thing a little bit. I'm also interested in how, you know, the two cultures of, you know, were people wary of each other in each different building? Was there kind of a like, we'll show you how to do this and you show us how to do that? It feels like, you know, at that time, because of the overwhelming digital versus traditional that was going on, that there'd be a sort of underlying tension. And did that come through after the merger?
I think that was, I think Flo and I tried to quash that, but I think we probably failed to do that because it was such an ingrained cultural thing, wasn't it? I think people from conventional ad agencies thought that we were cleverer and wittier and more insightful, and people from digital agencies thought that we were dinosaurs and had our heads up our asses, and they were probably right. But then, you know, that the problem is you end up needing 30 people writing code, and they've all got headphones on because they've got to concentrate on what they're doing. And then,
yeah.
So the culture is very different to two guys laughing their heads off about something funny they've just thought of with their feet on the table. And so that was difficult. That was difficult. And it wasn't just in our little office that was happening. I think that was happening on a macro scale. I think these two big aspects of our industry were rubbing up against each other, and it hadn't quite worked itself out. I think it has now, don't you? I think the best agencies are inherently social and digital anyway. I don't think we often preface our titles or our agency's skills with whether we're digital or not. That's a given. Don't you think?
Yeah, I think you kind of can't anymore. And I think because now people just assume advertising is all those things. So there isn't really a division between, or not a formal one anyway, between people who are doing, you know, what was more old school above the line stuff and what is now digital. The line's so blurred that, you know, you can't say you're one or the other and have a credible career anymore.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I always thought that, you know, like when people say what they – when a creative describes what they do in a very sort of specific way, it's like a footballer saying he's really good at taking corners or something. It's like you've got to be able to do everything and contribute. You know, you need to be you can't just be good at writing witty headlines or just good at doing Facebook apps. You know, we've got to be able to. You know, be able to sort of talk with each other and have random conversations, knowing that ultimately we're probably going to get somewhere interesting. And that requires, as you just said, that requires having the shared attitude, but the blurred edges on the skill set, which I think our industry's kind of got worked that out over the last few years. But it was at its most delineated and black and white when we merged, and we didn't manage to crack that. I think mergers are very complex things anyway. And so that wasn't just a merger of two companies, it was a merger of two parts of the industry. If it had worked, I think it would have been a fantastic template, which is what I was excited about. I'd probably, if I went back in time, I'd probably make the same decision to go for it again, because it made sense. I've also sort of learned that when people say it works well on paper, it means it's going to be shit.
Yeah, it's like that phrase, it is what it is, always means it is shit. No, it never means anything else, but it's like, yeah, it is what it is. Okay. I think that's interesting because that sort of takes us up to the inception, I guess, of Lucky Generals. And so what made you want to strike out on your own and have your own place? And you touched on Andy and Helen being friends from before. So had that conversation been rolling along a little bit in the background?
Yeah, it'd been rolling along in the background, but we did all disappear. And I went to Mother for just over a year to be a creative and be a creative director on a few accounts and things. And I absolutely loved it. But it was... I really loved it there. It was the culture was very exciting, intoxicating, and it was never going to say the fact that I always wanted to do my own thing, and even if that was with a couple of mates in a shed, and that would be fine. I just knew that I wanted to have the responsibility to do that, and it wasn't. That isn't a. I think it's just. I think that's what it is. I think it's to have to wake up in the morning knowing you're responsible for something is very exciting, because you have to get out of bed and then make it happen. You can't just go into somewhere and plug yourself into an ecosystem which would have worked if you'd rung in sick. You know, you have to make it happen, then you've got to do it. It's entirely, I think as a kid, I remember saying whenever I said I was bored, I'd get massive bollocking for that. You know, you can't, it's the worst crime. You can't be bored. You've got to solve that one yourself. You know, you've got to make yourself not bored and seek excitement and try and find fun things to do. And that's why I needed to do certainly set something up myself, so then we could try and make our own way in finding pleasure in our jobs and hopefully make a living out of that.
Yeah, so when you sort of had the idea or whatever, I guess, you know, you were all sort of talking about it. When did sort of push come to shove? When did you go, right, this is it, we're doing this and there's no turning back?
Oh, I was faffing around as usual. I was procrastinating because I was immersed in some fun stuff at Mother, so I wasn't quite I think Andy and Helen had left, and so they were Andy had got some consultant job, and I think Helen likewise. And so they were, as usual, they were the best people at making the machine start up and operate. And they rang me and said, "Come on, we've got to do this." And I said, "Yeah, you're right, let's do it." So it was driven by them, and it was a very, very special time, which I encourage anyone who's has any desire to start up their own thing, I would urge them to do it, but critically to treasure the bit at the start, because if it's a success, which it will be, then you will be cursed by the fact that you'll look back at the bit when you didn't know it was going to be a success, and you didn't know whether you'd ever be able to hire anyone or have a coffee machine or have a client that would actually ring up and need something. You know, we had 3 months of that. We had, you know, 4 months, because we intentionally started. This is another thing that I would recommend as well. We started, if you can do this, it's a very sort of potent thing, is start with no client, start with no backing, no investors, start with no promises, just start with you and a couple of people that you believe you stand a chance with, because you have a friendship or a bond that you think is important and strong. And because then you spend a very important bit of time working out who you are, rather than just telling that your investor that's going to be okay, or immediately starting with this client that's going to flood who you are with what they are. I think working out who you are and what makes you tick, because the most important thing you ever have is your own culture and identity and how you're perceived. That's the thing that you form at the start, and that's the thing that it needs to be very, very robust. And having that special time, that precious moment where you can really craft that and interrogate that and work out who you are and what you're about, and therefore what you'd offer and how could this ever work as a business, is a very, very important bit of thinking time.
Yeah, and I find it fascinating, because when most agencies start up, they have a gimmick of some sort. You know, if you look around on agency websites, they'll have some combination of Venn diagrams or some way of doing, and they go, "We call it the blah blah," and it generally comes down to something fairly similar to what a normal ad agency is anyway. And I find it really funny, from being somewhat on the inside of that, like when we did Luna, we were like, what's going to differentiate us to make anyone choose us over somebody else? But when you're talking about working out who you are, what did you work yourselves out to actually be? What was the result of that process for you?
So we sat in this shitty little office that was, you've got to back yourself, you know, and we ended up in one of those managed offices where they give you all the things they think you need for your day at work very, very sharp pencils and some lime cordial and some Fox's Glacier mints. And you sit in his office and you I was only ever asked two questions by everyone at the same time. At that moment in time, everyone would ask me two questions. One would be, what's your differentiating? What are you about? What's your point?
Yeah.
Exactly as you've just said, they wanted this elevator pitch about something that you can't get anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also asked me, what's your exit strategy? And I was thinking, we haven't even got chairs. And let alone clients, let alone 5-6 years down the line, 10 years, whatever it is. We haven't started, let alone finished. So forget the exit thing. And then we realized... we invested heavily in some post-it notes, and I don't know why they were orange, and we only had a green marker pen. It looked, art directionally, it looked terrible, but we managed to write everything that we thought that we were shit at, everything we thought we were good at, and everything we wanted to do, and we put them into three columns, and the things that we thought we were good at. And the things we wanted to learn or learn to be good at, that became defining. We put those to one side, and then we looked at all the things that we're shit at, and all the things that we weren't any good at were all the things we didn't want to do anyway. So we said, right, we can't do any of that. So let's not pretend that we are doing that just because it might pay. Let's just focus on this stuff. And all it really was, to be honest, Ben, was we decided paranoid that we were, oh, here we go. Guess what? It's a creative, a planner, and a suit. Fucking hell. They haven't even got a digital, let alone a social person. So there's all that. And then I think we just decided that you don't question that of your local butcher when he sets up. You just want the meat to be really good and you want him to be friendly. You just be good at be the best you can be at what you do, and those what you do should be what you enjoy doing, because that's probably what you do best anyway. And that starts to be driven attitudinally, and which then becomes cultural, rather than driven by, as you said, a PowerPoint that you'll keep. I would forget anyway. It has to be a gut pathological thing. You know, what's this about? Why are we doing this? And we ended up just sort of saying it needs to be fun and it needs to be fizzy and we need to be happy and we need to feel excited and scared and thrilled and all of those things. There's no science there, and I can't do a bloody TED talk about that. You know, there wasn't anything. Let's just go for it. And hold hands and do it, and that ended up being probably the best thing we ever had. Really, was an attitude and a desire and a sort of a friendship.
And did you have any kind of philosophy about what you kind of wanted the agency to be in terms of maybe what you would take on or what you wouldn't take on or anything like that?
Yeah, we had this hilarious list of, and this isn't. We had this list of things that we'd turned down. And that wasn't, I'm not sharing that with you to say, oh, we were great, we said no to those things, other than to illustrate that saying no to stuff was again, it's critical. Saying no is a very, very important part of informing who you are. And we had this list of stuff that would have enabled us to actually have a salary that we'd said no to. And for some reason we'd chosen to have no money and no chairs and no clients, but we still felt as though we never felt people. That's the other thing. Sorry, there was one other thing people kept saying to me: "Aren't you scared? Isn't it frightening?" And it never was, never was. Because the worst thing that could happen is that we would go and try and get a job somewhere, and that's probably what we would have had to be doing anyway. So. I think you've just got to go for it. And we never had a massive, our mission, weirdly, is we are a creative company for people on a mission. Just have a mission, whether that's to do the best work you've ever done, or if you're a client and you want to steal market share, or you want to, whatever it is, come here and let's help each other achieve what we're aiming to do, rather than it's driven by ambition and desire. It's driven by emotional stuff rather than rational things, which I think comes perhaps more naturally to us anyway, or certainly to me.
Yeah, I was talking to Ben Priest about this kind of time in his agency as well. And I think what's kind of interesting and maybe what applies to you is what kind of was it that allowed you to then put yourself forward as an agency for clients? He said they were always the sort of little outsider in some ways, which is funny to think of now because they're who they are. But yeah. Who were you when you were kind of putting yourself out as a sort of brand at the beginning, or as a potential agency at the beginning?
Our name ended up being really helpful. It was a shortcut to the attitude that we were able to sort of present to potential clients. It was Lucky Generals was a Napoleon quote, which I'd read as a teenager and thought, wow, one day I'm going to be in a band and that'll be a good name. And then I wasn't. I ended up in an advertising agency with that name. I like Lucky. I really liked it in our industry when it was all about precision and data. And I liked the fact that you can just be jammy. And what that means is, of course, you have to be. You have to work hard. You create your own luck and all of that kind of thing. So we're able to say. That we, as Lucky Generals, we would. I mean, his quote was Napoleon. The Napoleon quote was, "Bring me Lucky Generals." So it was to win a war, you know. So we're able to say to clients, you know, let's whatever your battle that you're facing as a business, you know, let us go and help you fight it, you know, and we'll be lucky. It sort of helped. I remember saying it. The first person I shared it to was Bob Saville, and he said, "You'll make that a good name." And I thought that's a brilliant answer. You only grow into your name and make your name like naming your children. Same thing, isn't it, Ben? You name your children, then they grow into that name.
Yeah.
You. We've sort of grown into Lucky and Generals as a gang of people who are lucky, and it feels as though we. Are able to answer your question, that you then, that's what you exude and you try and excite potential clients with, the fact that let's try and enhance our chances of being lucky. Let's look at disinformation or this aspect of the business or this creative opportunity. Well, how are we going to get lucky? How are our planets going to align? You know, we can't ever promise that this will be the most tweeted thing that your brand's ever done, but we can put everything in place to ensure that we might just get lucky. And that was a nice way to talk. It allowed us to be more ourselves and be a little bit more relaxed.
Was there a point where you felt it had become a success? Like you were right, we're now rolling, and we're not in a stage where is it going to work? Is it going to work? We're at a stage where it is working, and we've got there to some degree.
You take off, and rivets and paneling is flying off this thing. As you tear off at 100 miles an hour. That's what I was hoping, except it didn't. We sat in a room and our phone kept ringing because some fucking website called Hard to Find Wines had put our phone number on their website. So we got a call 20 times a day to the point where I'd answer it saying, "Hello, Hard to Find Wines," and then someone say, "Ah, excellent, I'm looking for a Shiraz from two, or whatever." And then we got no calls. And so... when we got you have these little moments of achievement. I don't today, talking to you right now, I don't feel as though we've achieved things that I know we could do if we get lucky on some stuff next month or whatever. I still think that you have to feel as though you have got tons to do, and we right now we do. And so at that particular time when we started, a client wanting to have a meeting with us felt like a success. And then that potentially being a pitch, or getting a call from an intermediary saying, someone would like you to look at something, I've got to be honest, you're a wild card. All of that stuff's great. That's progress. So you have these little incremental steps rather than it's always progress rather than an absolute moment of realize you do not feel you've reached success. You in fact you shouldn't, and we haven't.
Yeah,
but you do get into orbit. I think that's probably fair. I think you get to the whole thing so hand to mouth now, maybe more than it ever was. But you are given crumbs from tables, and those crumbs you've got to turn into the best thing you could possibly be given, because it's more likely that three people in a room and a couple of young lads from Watford are going to only be given a little project from the big shiny client rather than the entire global piece of business. So you've got to take those little bits and do the best you can with those, because then that, if nothing else, that becomes a bit of work that the agency has done. So people can now see what you are about. You know, all you ever have is the work that you make, and the culture that creates that. Otherwise, we've got three printers and a yucca plant. We've got nothing. There's nothing other than the culture that we try and create and maintain, and the work, the body of work that is out there. That was that's all you ever have. And I think making that the best it could possibly be is so important. And one of our post-it notes said, "Or die trying." And I think that was we left that one up, and I think that's really good. You just got to really go for it, and you might not always. I get really annoyed with people, and it's probably because, like I said ages earlier, Ben, that I was crap at the detail of graphics. I like the big squeaky pen bit. I get annoyed when people are so finicky around the pursuit of perfection, and I prefer to just. Let's have pizzas late at night and try and laugh until no noise comes out, and then let's write it and let's press send first thing in the morning, rather than let's spend 3 weeks crafting this. And that's just, there's no right or wrong. It just, I prefer the fast, energized thing. I'm not allowed to say I'm bored, but I would get bored if I didn't keep chasing making stuff. I think if you're a creative, or you're a creative director, or you're a creative company, then you have to create. Otherwise, you're just a meetings company or a PowerPoint company. You have to make stuff. And it might be brilliant, or it might not be quite as good as it could have been. But that's all right, because it exists. So let's go on, make something else that's better because of what we've learned from making this thing. I think that's something that the tech industry does brilliantly, and I think we, as an industry, would benefit from making more stuff. I think we end up being fearful of not being perfect, so we research things to death and to the point where nothing ever happens, and a year's gone by and you never made anything, and it's such a sad waste of talent. I can't remember why I got onto that. That was my little rant.
I mean, it was a good one, though. It was good. So,
yeah. Do you know what I mean? I think there's brilliant people in agencies who are sat in meetings thinking, we talked about this 3 months ago, when are we ever going to do anything? And the problem is, there are people in jobs, and their job is to ensure that you never make anything, because then they wouldn't be able to research it and analyze it and interrogate whether it would ever work if you ever did it or not. So it will never happen, and that pisses me off. And that's why I'm always full of praise for anyone who makes anything. a mate of mine wrote a book, and he gave me his book, and I was absolutely terrified that I'd hate it, and I didn't. I quite liked it, but more than that, I remember holding it and seeing his name on the front and thinking, he's written a book, and it exists, and it's in my hands. I can flick the pages and smell the paper, and he's made it. It isn't just a thing that he might do next year. It's physical, and I think that's what creativity is. It's creating, and it's hard to do that, weirdly.
Yeah, it is. I think George Lois and Dave Trott have mentioned that quite a lot. And George Lois is like, you know, a drawer full of roughs is nothing. You basically haven't done a single thing if you've come up with lots of good ideas that you haven't made. So until it exists in the real world, you might as well have done absolutely nothing on it at all. And I think the industry now is somewhat guilty of selling a lot of services to clients that are that thing. We'll do a brand audit for you. You know, we'll do a deep dive for a couple of months into maybe where you should go and whatever, and we'll research these things. And you're right. It's quite, as a creative person, it's quite depressing to say that that's what you did with your day. You did a bunch of pieces of paper that never saw the light of day that people had a chat about. And
And they were chemicals that bounced around in your head, and they got excited and agitated for a few seconds and then fizzled off and started thinking about your shopping again. You know, you have to capture those and make them. And I think that one of the really important, it'd be interesting to hear what you think about this. I think one of the important aspects of being a creative is being able to articulate and persuade and make it happen. In a way, more so now than it might have been when we started, Ben, when you were able to close your door and go back into your wacky office and wait for someone else to tell you whether the dickhead had bought it or not. I think now, critically, a creative, if they're going to create something, then they have to help make the create an atmosphere of trust, of understanding, of all those things. I think that is part of the creative process. And I don't mean manipulation. I don't mean persuasion in a duplicitous way. I mean, how do we listen and understand what the problem is? Therefore, we can apply creativity to cut through to people who right now don't give a shit about your new toothpaste or whatever it is. And I think that's going back to this simple thing. Let's find some friends that we trust and respect, and let's talk about stuff, because it's really, you know what it's like. It's lovely, isn't it? It's that moment when the idea is bubbling up, and it's you can't wait to, each of you are trying to finish the sentence and capture it, and then holding on to that energy and then sharing that or bringing in people who will make it better is fabulous. I think that's the thing that drew me, and I guess you and many others, into the industry in the first place. And when that happens, it's so great. And when it doesn't, it's a tragic waste. So make it happen. That's the thing. You've got to do it.
Yeah, I've interestingly heard a couple of stories of that being very much the case. I had a pre-chat with Walter Campbell, who I'll be doing a proper chat with at some point in the future. And he was telling me how Dunlop Unexpected got sold, and he said something along the lines of, and so, well, we came up with the idea for Unexpected, and we had the meeting and blah 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 blah, and I went, hang on, what, you came up with the idea of doing an S&M based ad with gimp suits for a tire company? Can you just come back to how that actually got sold? Because I know you didn't just go in and go, hey, gimp suits and blah, 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 can we have $500,000, please? And so he explained how it happened. But I also remember either I was talking to Tony McTeer or someone else told me this, but I heard that when PlayStation Mountain, when he thought about it, he had to go around to all the individual PlayStation clients and get them to say yes, because it was a Europe-wide ad. And it meant that he had to get their buy-in, partly for the budget, but partly for them to all endorse it. And he did that. That may be apocryphal or not true or whatever, but that was what I heard. And those are two of the best ads of the last 20, 30 years. And it wasn't just coming up with them. It was pushing them through and selling them, you know.
Yeah, and that enthusiasm is infectious. That can create the trust that may not have been in place in the first place. If someone arrives in your office and says, I think this can really answer your problem that I listen to, and it takes a creative leap that I think will engage the minds of people who are thinking of other things right now, you know, that's what we were briefed on in the first place. And if you can do that in a compelling way and really mean it, then you're also, I think you're also then allowed to say no or disagree with that client, because there is that trust. And so when you say no, then it's because it matters, rather than you're just being a belligerent, old school, shitty creative. You're saying no because, remember, we agreed that we were going to try and do this. I think that investment in the relationship with a person who's charged you with solving their problem in the first place is so important. And I've got that right on occasions, and I've got that tragically wrong on some as well. I remember once I was in an edit, and I was perhaps I'd done the classic, you know, we've all done this, the brief to do the 30-second ad, and you're in the edit suite at night, and you've done the 90.
Yeah.
And I remember doing fucking self-indulgent 90, but being really excited about it. And then I texted the female client that night, full of just sort of giddy about how excited I was. And I read the text the following morning, and it said, "Hi, we've done the 30 and it's great, but I've done a 90-second one, which I'd love to show you. All I ask is that you keep an open minge." Honestly, and I swear, my body temperature rocketed, and the fact, you know, the damn you auto spell or whatever it's called, you know, that was the worst. And to her massive credit, a text came in at about 9 o'clock from her, and it said, "I hope I like it that much." I mean, she called me on this. She said, "You obviously write the word minged more times than you write the word mine in your text." So, again, it was, I don't know, that was an accidental way to fortuitously get some trust and a nice relationship with somebody. And we ended up doing the 90 for the launch spot and things like that. So my point there is that relationship and listening and being on the same side sometimes is always important. Sometimes, particularly when you can just be seen as the creative, you know, those conversations when they always say, "I'm not the creative, I'll leave that to you guys." You know, yeah. That's when the next thing they're going to tell you is the most important thing. They're going to give you what they want in the best way they can articulate it. And that's the bit you have to listen to and go away and make better in a way that you should be able to do more so than they would have been able to without you. So.
So you're a sort of interesting place now where you're back in TBWA, weirdly enough, or they're in you. I can't tell which way it is. So what's the kind of goal and the target and the reasoning behind that?
Yeah, we got to a stage where we were on a sort of tipping point with the opportunities that we could expand and grow, and I mean as an agency, but also the kind of pieces of business that we could work on. There was dialogue happening with big things which were very exciting that we probably weren't, and we had a couple of chats where people said, "Do you know what, you're a year off or 2 years off, and you don't want to hear that when you're in your 40s. It's fine if you're in your 30s but we had we had ambition, but we didn't have money and we didn't have time. So we were fortunate enough to get a few people knocking on our door, and we were quite able to politely but very quickly say no to lots of them because it would impact negatively on our ambition or who we felt we were or wanted to be. But then TBWA contacted us, and they were able to, because of everything that I'd experienced with TBWA anyway, I trusted and liked them, and they were able to accelerate things for us. And when it got down to, there was one critical moment when I said, the reason I've always been skeptical about this kind of thing is I wouldn't want to change what we've been trying to create. That's the most important thing to me, is what we've been trying to create. And the guys who I liked anyway at TWA said, why would we be interested in investing in something if we were going to change it? And I remember thinking that made a lot of sense. And I thought that was a smart thing, because at stroke, I realized that they liked us and what we were doing, and they wanted to help be a part of it. And from our perspective, it meant that we could do bigger stuff on global stuff and invest in talent. I'm getting more teams, and growing on our social and digital, and we're able to be a little bit more grown up than we were, and in a good way, I think. And they were the right people to hold on to. As I said, you know, with Trev in London, they TWA championed the fact that they're a network of independents, and so when I said, and Helen and Andy said, we want to be independent, we still want to be Lucky Generals, they said, yeah, I know, of course you do. We'd just like you to be in our family. And we were never going to do anything. We were never going to merge with anyone or be dissolved into something, because we liked our little thing, our little gang. And so did they. So it's new days, but we like the people. And I mean, we like the people on a let's go for a beer kind of level as well, which is always a good test. So yeah, it's early days, but we feel positive. Sometimes we feel relieved as well. And then on more slightly wanky, indulgent ways, you look back and you think, oh, that was good when we didn't have any, when there was just three of us and we were trying to work out whether we needed some cushions. You know, that's why I'd urge anyone starting now is to just treasure all of those moments.
Absolutely. I think it's also worth saying that whenever I speak to anyone and your name comes up, it's always as the nicest guy in advertising. I think it's worth probably mentioning to people that being a pleasant and nice person can certainly help. And I think listening to your journey through coming from TBWA Manchester through to kind of almost full circle in a weird way back to TBWA through a bunch of other places. I imagine that served you well, not being an asshole. And
Bob Savile once said, it's nice of you to say that. Of course, it's lovely to hear you say that. Bob Savile once told me that I was the self-proclaimed nicest man in advertising. I thought it was better. I you know, tell you what sums it up. When you go to Cannes and you walk down the Quisette and you think, I hate this. Why have I come here? I haven't got one of those. I haven't got chinos and a polo shirt and a swinging lanyard. I am not interested in going in those. I can't even get in those fucking hotels now anyway. So I'm going to go three blocks back and sit here and have a beer. That's what I did this summer, and I was thinking, I hate this. This is shit. It's everything that this industry's changed. I spent hours in the same crappy little pub bumping into people who make me laugh and make me happy. And I've got so many friends in this industry, and I've met my wife in this industry. I think it still attracts bright, optimistic, buoyant, healthily sardonic, sarky, and snidey when we need to be. But I think it's a good. I think there's good people, and I like that, and I like to be part of that. And chatting to you is nice as well. So,
yeah, same here. Cool. Well, I think we've got to a sort of, that feels like a sort of endish kind of point. Unless there's anything else you wanted to say or talk about or mention that we haven't covered.
No, I think that's it. I think I think I've doing something like this is nice and very flattering. I found myself at a stage where, particularly when you start your own thing and there's now a whole big department, you end up realizing that you're a little bit more paternal than you think you are. And I'm very worried about being the embarrassing dad who hasn't left yet when we're in the pub. So the being able to offer any advice to people is new to me, really, and slightly alien. But I just, particularly the last few years, I would, anyone who's got any little feeling about maybe it should start something, I would urge them to do it, because they'll kick themselves if they don't.
Well, yeah, I think that's a very good piece of advice to end on. And, you know, it goes well with, you know, the story that you've said. But also, I mean, I think in doing this like mini series within the podcast of people who've started up places, it does feel like there's an overwhelmingly positive vibe towards doing it. Partly because I think I don't know if I'm talking to people who started and then got a bit abortive and then kind of failed. It's more people I'm talking to that it kind of succeeded in one way or another. But, you know, I think it's great to have that as a positive note to end on when it feels a little bit like the industry itself is having this weird sort of data creative battle and people don't know where we're going, and people keep saying that really annoying statistic of, well, back in the day, you know, people used to like the ads more than the programs. Now that chart's gone all the way down the toilet. And I'm going, well, my God, there's like a million different things. The planet's a different place, blah, blah, blah. Maybe the advertising's got worse. I don't know. But I still think it's going to be there as an industry. And I think having some sort of positivity towards what it can be, what it can do, both personally and in a wider kind of context, is, you know, a great way to be. And, you know, thanks very much for your positive point of view on things.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you for chatting. I really enjoyed that. Have fun in LA, and I hope your rollerblading goes well today.
It will, yeah. I've got a couple of hours scheduled. Okay. Cheers, Danny.
Cheers, Ben. Bye, mate.
Thanks. Bye.
If this is a podcast, then what's Christmas?